It's another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want to learn more about Hope, you can at investinghope.com. You can read our blog. You can listen to the archive of this show via podcast at investinghope.com. Also find it on iTunes and, of course, Podbeam, anywhere else podcasts are found. Or if you find yourself in your car or in your house or wherever you have your radio and you want to listen to it live, you can at Joy 620 at 5 p.m. every single Tuesday afternoon. And we are certainly grateful that you would tune in, and met some of you the other night at our banquet who listened to the show and are certainly grateful for you listening. We had some folks volunteering at Hope over the weekend and mentioned that they listened to the show as well. So we are just grateful for those that would partner with us in the work that we do at Hope Resource Center, and certainly grateful that you would listen as well. As we talk about life and the issues surrounding not just the state of Tennessee, not just pregnancy centers, but across the country. So that's what we're going to do today, is talk about more so the pro-life movement, talk a little bit about the banquet that we had last week, and talk about some issues that are facing our country and that we're seeing around the nation when it comes to abortion and life, and how we can involve or get involved and engaged in the process and see that things would be changed. First and foremost, we had an amazing night last Thursday night for our annual banquet, and are certainly thankful for those that came out and joined us, those that wrote checks, that paid with card, that donated and partnered with us at Hope Resource Center. We had the tally is still out, roughly just over $150,000 donated for the banquet, and we are certainly grateful for that. We anticipate more funds coming in, and I'll give you some final numbers as we get them in the next few weeks. But man, it was just an amazing night, as we heard from Jerrica and her story, and maybe I'll play a summary here in a little while, a summary of the night from. And you'll hear a little bit from Jerrica as well as myself. And so we'll try to get that queued up here in a little bit. But, man, it was just an amazing night to come together to see folks that are of like mind. And we had 60% of those that came to the banquet did not come to the banquet last year. So what that means is more and more people are finding out about the work of Hope Resource Center. They're wanting to partner in some shape, form, or fashion. And we were thankful for that. Also saw this year more young people, which is always fun to see, coming out and boldly standing for life. So we are thankful for that. What I want to do today is talk about a couple things that are going on in the news. One being recently, the conversation that has occurred really since the beginning of the year, and we're seeing it pop back up in the news here of late as President Trump is mentioning it, and it's talking about the governor of Virginia and how he discussed. Hey, he said this in a radio interview. He says that it was taken out of context. It certainly was not taken out of context. He did say that if a baby survives an abortion, a botched abortion, that they'll make that baby comfortable, and that then the doctor and the mom will have a discussion on what to do with that baby, resuscitate if necessary or not. So what he's saying is we're not going to give the care needed to a child that survives a botched abortion, just like any other child would receive. We're going to discuss whether or not to keep that child alive. And that's a very extreme position that makes a lot of us uncomfortable, and certainly should. And I say that's extreme, but what we have seen with many folks that are running for office currently, that are running for president especially, have come out and been in favor of abortion throughout 9 months of pregnancy, and also we've had pieces of legislation in Washington that look to be passed to say, look, if a child survives a botched abortion, they should receive the same care as any other child. But the reality is they're not receiving the same care. And we've seen a story after story that's showing that. But we're also not seeing that piece of legislation pass because it's being blocked by certain members of in Washington. And when I say certain members, I mean an entire party in Washington is blocking any type of legislation that would seek to protect those that survive a botched abortion. And so what we've also found is many folks saying, well, look, late-term abortions need to be available because of the health of the mom. And we keep hearing that that narrative, that the only reason people get late-term abortions is because of the health of the mom. Now, what they don't talk about is what health of the mom actually means and truly looking at the definition of that. But we'll put that on the shelf for a second. The reality is they say that, and their argument is, late-term abortions only occur when the health of the mom is at stake. Is that a true statement? Well, no, it's not. And I'm going to read you an article from Live Action that tells that that's not a true statement, and it's actually been proven to not be true by a study being done actually by the abortion lobby. So they actually went against their own argument by doing this study. So I'm going to start with the article. The abortion lobby claims that late-term abortion are rare and they are needed because of the health of the mother. But health is an ambiguous term which may include a host of reasons, which I was referring to earlier, including familial and emotional health. In a teaching module published by an abortion training program at the UCSF Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health reveals that physical health is almost never given as a reason for why a woman aborts after the first trimester. The module is presented by abortion provider Dr. Dre. Her name is Dr. Dre. You can't make this stuff up. The medical director of the Women's Options Center of San Francisco General Hospital, which commits abortions into the second trimester. She is also on staff at the Bixby Center at the University of California at San Francisco. Dre is embedded in the abortion industry and is a regular donor to Planned Parenthood's former special affiliate and research arm. Dre addresses the reasons for abortions late in pregnancy in the module. She says, abortion after the first trimester. Using a graph, she explains, by far and away, most abortions happen by 13 weeks or less. So to talk about abortion care after the first trimester, when we put this in context, if you were to add up all those small bars together, that represents about 11% of U.S. abortions. And really, I'd say, this is her the doctor being quoted right here, really I'd say the most difficult, politically challenging cases are those after 20 weeks. And that really is only 1% of abortions. Now think about that number. She says that's only 1% of abortions. Now, however, when we're talking about that, that's 1% of about 1.2 million, which means that's a fair number of women. Okay, so when you argue, hey, that's just 1%, it's just 1%, we shouldn't really worry about that. Well, what's 1% of 1.2 million? Well, that means approximately 100,000 abortions occur annually after the first trimester. 100,000 abortions is not a mere statistic that we need to throw to the side. Dre claims the women in these situations feel extremely bad and often judge themselves. She then breaks down reasons why women seek out abortions so late in pregnancy. And again, it's not what the abortion industry's public relations reps are telling the public. And this is a quote. When we look at why women present in the second trimester, there was a study that showed women's reasons for presenting at 16 weeks or beyond after their last menstrual period. And what they saw was that women often didn't realize they were pregnant. She continues, now healthcare providers often are very skeptical of this, but there are a lot of women who just may not realize they may have missed a period. And many women have bleeding during their pregnancies and that they interpret as period bleeding, and therefore time can pass. They may be looking after younger children. They may have had a relatively recent birth and they just don't realize that they're pregnant. Dre then claims that once women do realize they are pregnant late in pregnancy, quote, it becomes much more challenging to make the arrangement for an abortion beyond the first trimester because the abortions may be a two-day procedure and because there are far fewer providers, end quote. Dre goes further. It's very easy for women's obstacles to add up quite nicely and to delay her quite significantly due to having few financial resources or family support or transportation. Dre claimed her facility repeated the aforementioned study to determine why women have later abortions, saying, quote, we found that women, in general, had at least three reasons that had slowed them down and delayed them. Almost 60% were already past the first trimester before they even took a pregnancy test. They were less likely to have experienced pregnancy symptoms or didn't know when their last period was. Or, quote, they faced incredible logistic barriers. In a separate video titled Contextualizing Who Has Abortions After the First Trimester, Dre speaks with abortionist Daniel Grossman and claims that women who present in the second trimester have very fragile life circumstances. She mentions that many fetal diagnoses cannot be made until 18 to 20 weeks, but speaks mostly about how women aborting late have had financial hardship or unreliable abusive partners. Dre also claims that after the first trimester, abortion becomes emotional for the abortionist as well as the patient. What were those life circumstances Dre was referring to? Referral patterns were difficult, although she doesn't explain how. Had trouble finding where they could receive services, despite the fact that the internet has all of that information. Couldn't arrange transportation, no time off from job. And of course, a lack of taxpayer-funded abortion was one of the barriers that the doctor listed as well. Calling late-term abortion patients politically and medically vulnerable, Dre concludes that even abortion providers stigmatize them, and she admits what pro-lifers have said for years. The public opposes abortion after the first trimester. Okay, so the argument is the only reason anyone would ever get a late-term abortion, this is what we've heard from political leaders in Washington, this is what we heard from the abortion lobby, this is what we've heard from anyone that claims to be pro-choice, from the governor of Virginia to those in Illinois to the governor of New York. That's all we hear is, look, we need late-term abortion available because of the health of the mom. And then here you have a study from an abortion doctor where they even tried to say, look, maybe these numbers aren't correct. We're going to redo the study. And the numbers proved to be correct again, that actually late-term abortions occur, and even though it's 1% of all abortions, that's still 100,000 abortions a year, by their numbers, are late-term abortions, are done not because of health of the mom, but actually 60% of those, if not more, are done because they presented late, because they didn't take a pregnancy test till after the first trimester was over, because of financial barriers, because of they already had children, because they didn't know what the bleeding was. And then the abortion doctor comes out and says, well, and it's a little bit difficult because the public opposes late-term abortion. Yeah, they do. You know why? Because after 20 weeks, the baby is viable in this country. You want to talk about progress? You want to talk about science? And so it's interesting to me that we're even having this discussion. When their numbers, when their studies, when their research prove the pro-life point, they are proving our point that it's not just for health of the mom. Actually, it seems like that's never the case. And so can we have an honest dialogue and discussion on this issue for once? I doubt it. Because right now we are so polarized that we have one party saying and claiming they're pro-life, and then legislation doesn't necessarily back that up. And then you have another party in the country that just says, look, we're for abortion anytime, anywhere, for anyone, for any reason. So there's not a lot of middle ground where anybody can sit down and talk with each other. And frankly, I'll just be honest, I don't have middle ground. It's a black and white issue for me. That's a baby. That's a life that deserves protection. Protection. Full stop. We'll be back. Is he worthy? Is he worthy? Is he worthy of this? So when we talk about life, obviously, the bulk of our conversations every single week have to do with abortion and life and the pregnancy center movement, and that's what we spent the first segment on discussing. Is as we the conversation becomes difficult when we refuse to be rational and logical and be honest with each other. And so when you have people on both sides trying to have a discussion, trying to have a conversation, it becomes difficult when one side's part of them say, "Look, this only occurs because of fill in the blank, and in this case, because of life of the mother. That's the only reason late-term abortions occur." And then the pro-life side says, well, that's not true. We have the numbers. We know that That is not true. Yes, most abortions occur in the first trimester, but anything after that doesn't necessarily happen just because of the health of the mom. Well, then we're told that we're crazy and we're not compassionate and we don't care about women. Well, then the abortion lobby does their own study. So you have abortion doctors who are fully pro-choice, who are fully okay with providing abortions, doing their own study, and they actually prove the pro-life point that folks are getting abortions late term, not because of health, but because of situation, because they didn't know they were pregnant. Now they don't want this baby. They were, you know, hey, I haven't taken a pregnancy test and whoops, I'm 20 weeks pregnant. And so that's the concern from the pro-life side. But it's not just when it comes to the abortion life issue. Over the weekend, we saw once again another gathering of religious folks attacked. So you had Jewish folks attacked at their synagogue while they were celebrating, while they were praying, while they were coming together as a congregation. You had a white supremacist walk in there, and he killed one person. I think injured three or four others, and then he ran away. Why? Because he's a coward. And so when someone, a veteran of the armed forces, yelled at him and ran at him, what did he do? He cowered and ran away. And so in this case, you had good guys stand up, and thankfully there wasn't more lives lost, but one life is one life too many. A few weeks ago, you had an attack of a mosque in New Zealand by a white supremacist. And then last week at Easter in Sri Lanka, what did you have? You had Islamic terrorists attack Christians that were worshiping. And here's the thing. Regardless if you're Muslims, if you're Christian, if you're Jews, you should be able to worship freely if you're not attacking or harming others. You should feel like, okay, I can go to a worship service, I can go to a prayer service and not feel like I'm going to be attacked. But what it seems like to me, I was thinking about it this morning, as I was thinking about all of these things occurring, in times past, we didn't have internet. And so pretty much since I've been on this earth, the internet's been around in some shape or form. Obviously, in the last 15 years, it has really become what we know of it today. But I do remember a time where we didn't have, like if we were sitting around watching TV and somebody came up on screen and we're like, what is that guy's name? What else has he been in? We didn't say things like Google it and find out. We weren't able to talk to our Amazon Alexa. We weren't able to talk to Google. We weren't able to talk to Siri and have them find out for us. And what also we weren't able to do is, we've always had crazies. We've always had people that are psychopaths, that are lunatics around the country and around the world. But they felt like they were alone. They couldn't connect with other crazies and other lunatics. But what you have found in the internet age, the internet does a lot of wonderful things. It's been a blessing to a number of folks and to our country and to our world, certainly in progress. But what it's also done is it's given a way for crazies to come together. And I have no other way of saying that. So what did you see? You saw ISIS radicalizing people through the internet. They created Twitter accounts. They've created other forums where they have radicalized. Well, they even radicalized Americans. And Americans had left the greatest country on the planet to go fight overseas for ISIS. And they've lost their lives. And then with white supremacists, what have you seen? You've seen they have used the internet to connect other people. The guy that shot up the synagogue over the weekend, they have found that he went on 8chan and other places online and connected through forums with other extremists. The same thing with the guy in New Zealand. The same thing with the guys in Sri Lanka. That's what we've seen. So the internet has provided a way for these folks to connect. Why? Because everybody is looking for a community to feel loved and welcomed in. You see this when it comes to the KKK. You see this when it comes to gangs. You see this when it comes to white supremacists. You see this when it comes to Islamic terrorism and extremists. Everybody's looking for community. Now, there are some good communities and there are some bad communities. But they're looking for acceptance. They're looking for someone to say, you're part of us. Your ideas aren't crazy with us. And so what do we do as a society? Well, unfortunately, what we do as a society is when Christians are attacked, you have one group of people saying, Easter worshipers, we're not even going to say that they're Christians. When Jewish people are attacked, you have a segment of the population that says, well, they deserved it. When Muslims are attacked, you have a segment of the population that says, well, look back at 9/11. And so we paint with a broad brush, and in doing so, we are devaluing life. So when one attack happens, we want to tweet and we want everybody to come and support that group that was attacked. But when this other group was attacked, we may not say anything because it doesn't affect us. And so everything is so polarized. I'll tell you that, and maybe some of you that listen are not on Twitter and you're like, I don't even know what that is and that doesn't do anything for me. But for my generation, Twitter is an important tool for finding news, for interacting with other folks, for trolling, for being funny or whatever that may be. But it also creates a bitterness. And I found over the last couple of weeks, I have not gone to Twitter as much and I've been a happier person. I've not been as bitter, as hateful, as angry. And so when we see these things occurring across not just our country, but across the world, it is right now Venezuela there's fighting going on. In 2012, the Venezuelan government de-armed the population. And just 7 years later today, the government is literally running citizens over in vehicles. Why? Because they have no arms to protect themselves. They have no guns. And so right now, as I talk freely in the greatest country on the planet, there are people scared and not knowing if they're going to see tomorrow just simply because they live in Venezuela. And so we act as if oftentimes in America, as if all is terrible, woe is me. Folks, there are people, I can assure you, there are people in Venezuela right now that would do anything. To be in this country. There are people all over this planet that would do anything to be in this country. And we take that for granted. And we seek to devalue life when life's attacked. When vulnerable groups are attacked. And I would just throw out there to those that want to argue that we need to stand up for these vulnerable groups, I would 100% agree. But I would also argue that the unborn needs to be included in that vulnerable group, in those vulnerable groups, because they're the most vulnerable. And when I come back, I'm going to talk about what's going on in New York as we see the homicide rate is much lower than the abortion rate. And we're going to talk about what's going on in New York and what's going on around our country when we come back. So I told you, when we come back, we're going to talk about New York again. And I get it. Like, we're in Tennessee, if you're listening local, and you're like, what do I care about what's going on in New York? It's the same reason why you should care about what's going on in Venezuela. It's the same reason you should care about what's going on in Sri Lanka, what's going on in the Middle East. These are things that should not constantly run through our mind, but they certainly should be in our mind, in our hearts, and we should know what's going on. So shocking new government statistics show that there are more than four times as many late-term abortions in New York City as victims of homicide. So CNS News reported on the comparison earlier this week in response to mainstream news outlets' claims that late-term abortions are rare. So again, the argument is late-term abortions are rare, so let's stop talking about it, which is Like, we don't use that argument on anything else. What do we hear when a school bus crashes? What do we hear? We need to do something, even though they are very rare. Those crashes are very rare. When someone dies in a drunk driving accident, what do we hear? We have to do something about it. When someone is shot, what do we hear? We need to do something about it. What do we constantly hear from leaders? If we can save one life, then it's well worth the fight. When we were having the healthcare discussion in Washington and across this country, what do we hear all the time? If we can save one life, then it's worth the fight and the time. But now what we're hearing is, well, late-term abortions are rare, so quit talking about it. You just keep talking about late-term abortions, but they are so rare, they don't even deserve our time or our conversation. Well, it's not true. The comparison is based on statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and the New York Police Department. The latest CDC report on abortion provides the numbers for 2015. In New York City, there were 1,485 abortions at or after 21 weeks gestation that year. In contrast, the NYPD and the Federal Bureau of Investigation reported 352 victims of murder and non-negligent manslaughter in New York City in 2015. That equates to 4.1 late-term unborn victims of abortion and 0.96 victims of homicide per year in the city, according to the report. In the U.S. as a whole, there are thousands of unborn babies aborted at or after 21 weeks annually. In 2015, the total was 5,597, according to the CDC. However, the number is actually much higher. The CDC totals include only 39 states that reported gestational ages. States that do not report gestational ages to the CDC are California, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. While New York State does not, New York City does. The city saw 63,610 abortions in 2015, according to the report. Abortion statistics from New York City demonstrate the rampant destruction of abortion on unborn babies' lives. Pro-lifers have pointed out for years that more unborn African-American babies are aborted than are born in the city. In the future, New York could see even more late-term abortions after they pass the law that we have discussed many times on this show. The so-called Reproductive Health Act goes beyond Roe v. Wade, allowing unborn babies to be aborted after viability for any loosely defined quote-unquote health reason. Abortions after 24 weeks now are allowed and non-doctors are allowed to perform them. What's more, if viable unborn babies survive the abortion, the state no longer requires that they be protected. Nearly 1 million unborn babies are aborted every year in this country. Since Roe v. Wade, more than 61 million abortions have occurred in the U.S. So why do those numbers matter? They matter because, again, if we're going to have a conversation about life, and if we're going to say, look, the lives in Venezuela matter, if we're going to say the lives at that synagogue in California matter and have value, the lives in New Zealand matter and have value, if we're going to say these things, if we're going to say the lives in Sri Lanka have value and matter, the lives at schools, just this week in Tennessee, in Cumberland County, over in Crossville, 2 sixth graders were picked up because they were planning an attack on the school on the last day of school. They were going to come in through the back doors, start shooting people, and then commit suicide. That was their plan. 6th graders. Now, we would argue that every child in that school has value. And we need to do whatever we can to protect life outside the womb. So why are we not being as engaged in the lives inside the womb? So it's hard for me when I hear certain leaders, not just politicians, but when I hear certain leaders say that we need to do everything we can to protect life. We need to fight hard for these policies that are going to protect life. We need to love on our communities. We need to be involved in our cities, in our towns, in our rural communities. When there's a flood out in Nebraska, we need to do something about it. When a hurricane hits the coast, we need to do something about it. You have political candidates right now saying that we actually have 10 years left on this earth. Beto came out this week and in an interview said we have 10 years left if we don't act now. Now, in that interview, the interviewer just nodded their head and agreed with him. But you have some crazy spiritual guy come out and say, we got 10 years left. And what do? They go, that dude's crazy. And so you have all these folks saying that we need to do something about protecting life. And then you let one person, one pro-lifer come out and say, look, I agree with you. All these lives have value. When a hurricane strikes, we do need to act. When floods occur, we do need to act. When a school is shot up, we do need to act. And when abortion becomes rampant, we do need to act. And then I'm called an extremist, and I'm called I'm told that I'm against women. No, that's not true. Let's just say half the babies that have been aborted were females. And so when we have this conversation, look, I'm all for life. But to me, we get it wrong if we don't first get it right inside the womb. And so it's hard for me to hear from political leaders or anyone else that's saying we got to do more for our people. We got to do more for the stranger in the city. We got to do more for our neighbors, when they care none about the stranger, the neighbor in the womb, which is where we all got our start. And so that's why I'm concerned about what happened in New York. I don't think that the state of Tennessee anytime soon is going to be voting on legislation similar to that. No, I don't think that's the case. But it does concern me, what's going on around the country. It concerns me what I'm teaching my children. Am I teaching my children that some life is more valuable than other life? That life in the womb, not quite as valuable? Am I teaching my son that his little sisters are more valuable now than they were when they were inside their mom? Or was I telling my son and my other kids that, look, whether you were in the womb or out of the womb, your value never changed. Who created you never changed. The only thing that changed was proximity and time. That's it. At conception, my children, everything was planned. Their hair color. Were they going to be a boy or a girl? Their DNA, their blood type, all of those things. And as they were growing inside the womb and they were hearing me and my wife talk, they were actually picking up the dialect. They were picking up, hey, mom and dad's from the South. We're going to talk like Southerners. That's what we know through science. That it's ingrained in them. So to argue that it's just a clump of cells isn't picking up on dialect. A clump of cells isn't going to run from pain. Isn't going to recognize its mom's voice when it comes out. And so if we want to have a discussion and a dialogue and a conversation on the value of life, I am all for it. But the conversation must include life in the womb, or we get it all wrong, completely wrong. And also, we have to be honest. And so making the argument that late-term abortions only occur because of the health of the mom is not true. That is not being honest and transparent with the conversation. It's not true. And so let's have that dialogue. Let's come to the table and sit down and have this conversation. But at some point, it has to move from conversation to actually saying, we are going to protect the most vulnerable in our society. And the most vulnerable in our society are those that are in the womb. And politicians don't like to hear this, but they represent them as well. And so hopefully, we'll get to a point where we will have that conversation. We'll have folks that are being honest and trying to do right by others. But until we get to the place where Washington and our state capitals are having that conversation, it's very important that we would, within our churches, within our communities, would show that. So when I show my neighbor that I care deeply about them, that it doesn't just stop with them, that they would also see that I care deeply about those in the womb. And that's where life begins. That's what I want my kids to know. Life starts at conception and is valuable and precious at that moment. Not just because it comes out of a birth canal, but it was valuable and precious that entire time. Why? Because of the one that created it. We'll be back. Thank you so much for making 2019's Banquet Night a special one. We continue to be blown away at the generosity of our community partners as you sacrificially give of your time and treasure.
My name's Sherika. I'm really excited to be here.
I pray that tonight's message will stay with you as you continue to walk with hope.
As I walked into Hope on Tuesday, June 5th, with tears running down my face, I was not prepared for everything I was about to experience. The next thing I can remember so vividly is Wendy walking in with a smile. She looked at me, and she could see how nervous I was as she said, "Well, Miss Jerica, you are pregnant." My heart dropped. I told her I was scared everyone would leave, abandon me, and walk away. I was scheduled to come back the next Tuesday, June 12th, but Wendy and Christy knew. They just knew I didn't really plan on coming back for that next appointment. So what I thought was going to be for the last time, they wrapped their arms around me and they prayed for me. They impacted my decision because on Tuesday, June 12th, when I walked into my next appointment at Hope with my now husband and my mom, and the first thing I said was, "I am going to have this baby." Everyone, this is my amazing husband. This is Dustin. And this little beauty is Miss Ember. Miss Ember Hope.
Jerica's story of redemption, marriage, and motherhood wouldn't be possible without you. Hope staff wouldn't be possible without you. Our ultrasound machines and the thousands of lives they have given witness to would not be possible without you. We are truly grateful to partner with you in this work as we bear witness to the gospel moving in and out of our exam rooms as brokenness meets grace and grace overflows. Thanks again. So that's a quick summary of what happened last Thursday night at our banquet as we got to hear from Jerica. And for those of you that were there, man, Jerica's story is one that we have shared quite a bit. We shared with our year-end mailer. We shared it in our Sanctity of Life video. We shared it now at the banquet. And the reason why is because we think her story needs to be told. She believes her story needs to be told. Look, folks, we have a culture that is creating this mindset that Jerica, who has a very supportive mom, a very supportive at the time of her finding out she was pregnant, a fiance, but she had convinced herself that if she told them she was pregnant, they would abandon her. They would leave her. That her fiance would leave her. That her mom would disown her. She had convinced herself of that. She believed that to be true. But when she sat in our exam room and when our nurses met with her and said, "Look, if everyone leaves you, even if that were true, you're not going to be alone. We will become your family. We will step in." And that gave her the boldness to then sit down with her fiance. It gave her the boldness to sit down with her mom. And guess what? What she had convinced herself of was a lie. Her mom stepped up and has been amazing throughout this process. Her fiance stepped up and they went on and got married. And now Ember is here. The little girl is here. And then, man, wow, when we found out that she was naming her child Ember Hope, that her middle name is going to be Hope. Why? Because she has told us that Hope has become her family. We were the first ones that she celebrated with. And so that is why we do the work that we do. That is why you give. That is the impact that you're able to have by clicking that donate button at investinghope.com. You make a difference in the life of Jerica, Dustin, and Ember, and families like them all across this city. and babies like Ember all across this city. And since 1997, over 30,000 patients served. Think about the impact that you have had. And man, we could not be more grateful to partner with you, to stand with you as we celebrate life. I know that a lot of times we come on here every Tuesday and I talk about the issues going around, and at times it can be overwhelming, and at times it can seem like we may even be losing the fight. I can assure you we are not losing the fight. Look at Jerrica and what happened with her. We are not losing. That is a win. And that is a family that's complete because they had a place to go that loved them well, served them well. And so thank you for that. We'll talk to you next week. Only Jesus.